Welcome, everyone.
Welcome
to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle. It's a podcast about movies and wine.
It is a podcast about movies and wine.
For those of you out there who don't know shit about one or both, I'm Jamie. I'm the wine guy.
I'm Scott. I'm the movie guy. So last time we talked about the field of 10 nominees in general. Jamie picked a wine that everybody can drink along while they're watching the ceremony. And we talked about the first couple of nominees.
Today, we're going to wrap up our discussion on the Best Picture nominees. We hope you enjoyed last week's discussion. If you didn't, probably don't listen to this week's discussion. But like, you're here, so you might as well finish it out.
Yeah, I mean, like, if your podcatcher just, like, automatically downloaded and played this episode, fucking sorry. Like, you're stuck with it. But at least this time, we won't be talking about whatever thing you didn't enjoy us talking about last time.
And we're drunker now. Enjoy the show, everyone.
Next up, chronologically in my viewing order, is Licorice Pizza. So again, Licorice Pizza, the Paul Thomas Anderson film. What I told you is that it's shaggy. I described the movie earlier as a hangout movie, and a hangout movie just means like something where plot is kind of secondary, and maybe it's kind of an episodic narrative, and it's more about like a vibe and about characters and spending time. It's textured, I mean, both in terms of the grain and texture and light of the 35 millimeter film, but also it's textured in terms of like the details of the characters and the characterization and their relationships. Like, it's a movie, like, you've asked me about this before. I describe this one as spiky. The characters are allowed to be prickly and weird and to fail and to be unappealing, and you end up loving them even more because of that.
Because they're humans.
They're people. It is nostalgic. It's very much like this is not, like, PTA is kind of the chronicler of the San Fernando Valley. Like, he grew up in that area. That this movie feels very much like him looking back fondly on his own, like, adolescence growing up or coming up in the valley in the 70s. It is problematic. As I told you, there's a couple of things that are problematic about the movie, and we kind of have to, like, grapple with them. For one, just like the main narrative thrust is about a teenager who is like smitten with a 25-year-old. That's not something that's incidental to the movie. Like, the complexity and the inappropriateness of the age disparity is like,
Talked about.
It's the text of the movie. Like, yeah. He's interested in her, and she's like, I can't possibly keep spending time with this 15-year-old and this 15-year-old weirdo friends. And like, it's what it's about. And, you know, wherever it is that the movie takes it, the movie doesn't absolve the relationship and it doesn't endorse it, but it complicates it. The other area in which I find it problematic, and I'm not the best person to talk about this, but there's a character in the movie played by John Michael Higgins, who is like an obnoxious, stupid white man who has at least two Japanese wives in the movie, and he speaks to them in like English with this obnoxiously racist Japanese accent.
It's bad.
And the joke doesn't seem to be on him, and I don't know what it really adds to the movie except for some comedy that I found super cringy and not contextualized or balanced by anything else. And I find that character very problematic, and he really takes away from the movie for me. That overall, like, I loved the movie, but that character really bothers me.
I agree with you. I don't think having him do that adds anything to anything.
I mean, there's like an easy fix for it, and the movie doesn't go this route, which is the wives, the two different women playing his wives in the film, and like they run like Japanese restaurants, right? Like the first like sushi restaurants in the valley. But like the wives are not subtitled when they're speaking in Japanese. And like this would be easy, and this maybe would undercut what he's going for, but I don't understand what he's going for with the scenes. But like the easy thing would be to be like having him speaking in his racist Japanese accents, and then we see the wives subtitled and they're clearly like over his shit and not interested, and he's not translating them correctly at all. And the movie just like doesn't go that route. And it, like, the character is a buffoon, but he's still getting laughs because John Michael Higgins is just fucking funny. But
right.
Yeah, it's a problem. And then the last thing I told you about it is that it's a master's minor work. Like, this is minor PTA, which still makes it better than the best work that most other filmmakers would ever put out.
Right.
But it's definitely like him kind of oscillating between masterpieces, essentially. You saw this. You saw this with me.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't really talk about it too much. Were you on board with the Licorice Pizza?
I wasn't expecting to be.
Yeah.
And I really liked it. I was charmed by it, with the exception of the
racism
character that you're talking about.
Yeah.
Which I mostly really like forgot about. I kind of didn't consider it after I was annoyed by it. It doesn't have a lot of screen time, and the rest of the movie occupied much more of my brain space, yeah. I guess. You have to contend with the problematic age thing, but like you said, it's the text of the movie. I could see how it could take some people out of it and make them not particularly enjoy this viewing experience, but I was really compelled by all the characters, by the filmmaking. It just kind of made me smile a little bit.
Yeah, it's lovely, and it's a little troubled, and we kind of have to deal with that.
And I'm fine with it being a little troubled.
Yeah, the racism is harder and harder for me to grapple with that movie. Walter Chow, who's a terrific film critic that I really like, he writes for Film Freak Central. He's been featured recently a lot on NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. Very, very, very smart critic. I think one of the best voices in American film criticism right now. But he took the movie to task. He did a joint review of Licorice Pizza and Ghostbusters Afterlife
at the
same time. Okey-dokey. And just kind of talking about how like they're both like these products of like regressive nostalgia, which I thought was fascinating. But he's also like he's Asian American, and he can't overlook the like blatant racism of that character in the movie. And it was just something I thought about a lot, and I've thought about a lot since then. And it's hard for me to forgive it. And I wonder if I watched the movie again, if I would find more meaning in it, you know, like, right. I think thematically that character is part of a spectrum of like men who are full of shit. There's a lot of men who are full of shit in the movie, and that the reason that the Alana character is, I think, oftentimes so skeptical of the Gary character is that she's surrounded by men who are full of shit.
Correct.
Just like this guy. And Gary is also like a hustler and he's full of shit. And I can see how it fits, but depiction does not equal endorsement. I don't think that the movie, that everything needs to be appropriate or fair. Like, I'm not saying that we shouldn't depict racism, but it doesn't land enough. And the movie, just like the John Michael Higgins character, sidelines his two wives, the two Japanese women, and denies them any kind of agency in those scenes. And right. there's just nothing to justify it. And I just don't see why it's there.
I agree with that.
Yeah. But so you like the movie.
Yeah.
Wine. Where did all of these weird things, where did shaggy, textured, nostalgic, problematic, and a master's minor work take your brain?
I mean, shaggy and textured are ways that you can describe wine. So those led me to a particular place. Master's minor work got me thinking. I had thought about a number of different things, but those wines didn't really fit with the other things that you said. I threw out problematic because
reasonable.
There are no problems in the wine world and no problematic winemakers. No further questions. Thank you very much.
Got it. Definitely, for sure.
Absolutely did not want to talk about any problematic winemakers. Not going to do it. Threw it right the fuck out.
Perfectly fair.
And nostalgic was difficult. I feel like I maybe whiffed the ball on nostalgic here because I went with something from South Africa that has very much an eye toward the future more than it has an eye toward the past. So maybe contrapuntal, but I think I kind of went with shaggy textured and a master's minor work pairing.
Is shaggy in the ballpark of mousy?
No.
So that we're not talking about hair at all. Okay,
no,
good.
No, we're not. No.
Great.
All right. So I went with a Pinotage from South Africa made by the Southern Rite Winery, which was founded by Anthony Hamilton Russell of Hamilton Russell Winery. Hamilton Russell Winery is, for me, a landmark winery in Walker Bay in South Africa. It is the reason why I give attention to Pinot Noir and Chardonnay from South Africa. The wines that come out of that winery are really special. They're evocative. They taste different than any Pinot Noir or Chardonnay that I've had from anywhere else. And if I see them on a list, I'll basically almost always buy them. I think that they're great. Anthony Hamilton Russell started the Southern Rite Winery specifically to look at Pinotage, which is South Africa's grape.
So it's not like a different way to say another grape. This is a different grape. Different species.
Not different species. They're all Vitis vinifera.
God damn it. Different strain.
Variety.
Variety. Yes. Right. How do I not know that vocabulary word? So this is what? This is like a grape that is native to South Africa?
Not native to, but was developed in South Africa.
Mm.
It's a crossing of Pinot Noir and Cinsault. And it was developed in South Africa, and it has had its ups and downs. And largely over the past, I guess, 20 to 30 years, the public conception of Pinotage has not been great, because a lot of the wines that have been made have been really – Pinotage is very, very susceptible to Brettanomyces specifically. So a lot of these wines make the trip across the Atlantic Ocean. They get here to the United States, and they just taste like horse shit.
Is this metaphorical horse shit, or do they taste, is this in a barnyard thing?
You open it up and it tastes poopy.
Okay.
You're like, oh, that smells like poop. Don't like it.
So you mean literally poop?
Yep.
Okay.
Sure do.
Got it.
Bad. It's a problem. And a lot of people attributed that character to the grape itself and not to over-enthusiastic winemakers who just wanted to make a bunch of relatively inexpensive wine and sell it to the American market. Anthony Hamilton Russell had a different idea. He wanted to make Pinotage with a little bit more thought, with a little bit more skill. And I think he's succeeded. That having been said, Pinotage itself, the character of the grape feels really rustic. It feels a little shaggy. It's got the texture of it isn't like Pinot Noir, where it's got this really like fine-grained, silky tannin. It's got more of a like coarse, gravelly kind of feel in your mouth.
Tongue scraping astringency.
A little bit, yeah.
Harsh tannin.
Not as harsh, but more like grainy. It has that sort of shaggy, textured thing to it. But the wine itself is made by this guy who's got such a wealth of knowledge, who has such incredible skill, that the wine is compelling, right? It's totally cleanly presenting. There's a lot of attention to ripeness levels and cleanliness in the cellar, and that Brettanomyces problem isn't present in the Southern Rite wines. He has dealt with it and has made a wine that presents uniquely South African in its profile. You can't possibly make a wine like this anywhere else, partly because Pinotage is really only planted in South Africa, but also because of where these vineyards are situated. Their extreme southern coast in one of the coolest appellations, so overripeness isn't a problem. I find all of the wines that come from the Hamilton Russell family of wines to be super compelling, and I think the Pinotage really slides in as a great parallel for licorice pizza. The Chardonnay or the Pinot Noir wouldn't fit here. They would maybe fit with something else by Paul Thomas Anderson, like There Will Be Blood or Boogie Nights.
Or The Master.
Fucking. I should rewatch it. I should give it another chance.
Maybe that's what our next miniseries could be, is like Jamie has to rewatch things that he was wrong about before, and then we talk about them.
Yourself.
But then maybe you'll still be wrong about them, and then we'll have interesting discussions.
It's true.
It's not the worst idea.
It isn't.
It's pretty obnoxious, but it's not the worst idea.
It could work.
So where can people get this wine?
Firstwinedown.com for $30.
Hey, that's in the ballpark of the amount of money I would spend for a single bottle. Would I like this Pinotage?
I think you would. Yeah, I think so.
All right, next up. Oh, this is a funny happenstance. We're going from Licorice Pizza, featuring a very small scene-stealing performance from Bradley Cooper, onto Nightmare Alley, a movie starring and produced by the Coops. B. Coops.
Having a big year. He's good.
You still haven't watched A Star Is Born?
No, I haven't.
Fucking knockout, like writer, director, star, singer turn. But he's just like, that movie turned me around on him in a big way. He's got the goods. But so Nightmare Alley, I told you that it was fucking dark.
With several A's.
It's really dark.
It's very dark.
Super dark. I told you that it was affected with an A, as in putting on an affect. And what I mean by that is that the performances feel very much of like a pre-method era. Like it's like very old school, like 1940s noir. Like they're non-naturalistic performances. And I say that in the best possible way. Like they're big theatrical movie star screen performances. Cate Blanchett, who just like for the range that woman can pull off, like she just feels like she was just taken from another decade and plopped into our modern times.
She really does. It's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, in general, but especially in this movie. I told you it was fatalistic, which I don't know that that does anything for you in terms of wine, but that the end is inescapable from the beginning. And I've heard some people describe the movie as predictable, like, oh, I saw the end coming from the very beginning. I'm like, yes.
That is the point.
Congratulations. That is the point. Your character feels doomed from the very beginning. And that it is seductive. The movie's so fucking sexy. There's seduction from Toni Collette. There's a sexy bathtub seduction. You got some Rooney Mara being seduced and herself being seduction. And then Cate Blanchett just comes in and just like ramps up the fucking vamping for the whole back half of the movie.
Cate Blanchett.
Cate Blanchett's so good in the movie.
She's so good.
But yeah, so.
I had such a blast watching this movie. It was a wonderful viewing experience.
Yeah.
That I would like to replicate. I would like to watch it again.
I think you should, yeah. We've talked about this before. I think when we did our Marvel episode, my trolling Marvel episode with no actual MCU movies.
Yeah.
But we talked about Blade 2 that like secretly, like one of my great like movie shames is that like I prefer popcorn Guillermo to like art house, like gothic horror or gothic romance Guillermo. This one kind of swayed me back in the other direction. This one just worked for me on every fucking level.
I agree.
So Jamie, what did all of that, where did all that drive you for your pairing?
This one.
Oh my God, Jamie, you are out of control. I'm looking ahead at the price tag on this thing.
Yep.
Okay, go ahead.
Just deal with it. Wine's expensive sometimes. It is what it is. And I struggled with this one because I wanted something that was maybe more accessible price-wise, but like the way this movie is put together and the words that you use to describe it. And I settled on wanting to spotlight a category of wine that I shit talk a lot, but that I do actually love, which is Napa Valley Cabernet. I shit talk Napa Valley Cabernet because it's, you know, it's the one of the reasons why so many wines from around the world just go for extraction and high alcohol. Those wines are largely unsuccessful. They just taste like whiskey water. But when it's made thoughtfully from really, really high quality grapes, Cabernet Sauvignon from the Napa Valley can be something really magical. So I chose Dominus Estate Cabernet Sauvignon from Yountville in Napa Valley. It is available at TotalWine.com for $250. $250 is current vintage, although I think that a back vintage Dominus with this movie would be just magic.
And what are we talking about on price point?
A lot of dollars. So get you a friend that has a wine cellar that's north of 60 years old.
Yeah. Folks, if you would like to watch Nightmare Alley, all you need is a $8 a month Hulu subscription.
You know, I can't justify this wine in the same way that I can the Agripar in saying that, you know, it puts food on a family's table. This wine is part of the Moyex family of wines. Christian Moyex, who is the CEO of that company. That company holds, I think, 10 wineries in Bordeaux, including Chateau Trottinois, which is one of the most famous and expensive wines from that area. They also own Dominus and Napa Nook in California and several other wineries in other regions of France. We're talking about big generational wealth in this family. I can't justify it that way, but I can justify it in that these wines are fucking beautiful. They're dark and they're brooding and they are affected. It is the affect of being in Napa Valley and also the affect of being French in Napa Valley. This idea that they are making a more old world style of Napa Valley Cabernet, but it's actually false. Like this is unabashedly California. There's no amount of makeup. There's no amount of technique that you can put on this particular vineyard, which is one of the best in Napa Valley, that'll make it anything other than a Napa Valley wine. Big and powerful and brooding and sort of like knock your teeth out wine. And it's seductive. It's, you know, it's all of those things. It's big and powerful, but then it's round and it's plush and it just invites you to drink more. These wines are really, really special.
All right, Jamie, you obviously came up with a very thoughtful pairing here. You did the work. I'm not going to dispute the pairing. I find the price tag offensive. You are not helping the audience at all here. Listen, unless we have fancy rich people listening to the show, in which case, how would you like to sponsor our podcast?
Or if you are in the middle or upper middle class and you have an occasion coming up and you want to buy a very special wine for a special occasion, Dominus, Agrippar, these wines are, they're there for those times when you want to mark a point in your life with a beverage that is special. I think that it's worth the money.
I remain agnostic. I remain unconvinced.
I know you do.
That feels like too much. Although it does sound delicious. And again, a thoughtful pairing. There's something to be read into here in the movie. Spoilers, the second half of the film. B. Koops goes from being a carny to being like a fucking fancy mentalist who swindles rich people with all of his bullshit. And there's parallels to be drawn here that you're not drawing. That maybe the price tag on this wine is just a lie. Just to trick fancy people into spending too much money. You're not saying it. I'm not saying it either. I'm not making any false implications.
Well, listen, we've talked about this problem in Napa Valley already on the podcast. It's the price tag is a function of the real estate market also. Like, it's partly they can get this price from wine consumers, but also the real estate in Yountville is massively, massively expensive. And just purchasing the land necessitates that you charge a certain amount for the wine, let alone the farming practices that you put into it, the amount of barrels that you purchase, the what you pay your consulting winemaker, et cetera, ad infinitum. The price tag of the wine is reflective of the broader economic picture.
All right. I'll allow it.
I know you hate it. I know you hate it. And I hate it too. There is a point of diminishing returns that you reach. Like north of $300 a bottle at retail, It's really hard even for me, who's tasted a lot of those wines, to justify purchasing them. It's just rich people shit at that point. It's annoying. It's very annoying. And the difference between a $20 bottle and a $70 bottle is much, much bigger than the difference between a $200 bottle and a $250 bottle. And it's the same amount of dollars apart. So do with that what you will. Sometimes things cost a lot of money, but they're still compelling. That's just the way it is.
All right. Well, Jamie's only advocating for big wine here, everybody. Jamie's turned a corner. He's sold all of you all out, and he's just here talking about expensive wine.
F*** you, buddy.
All right. So now, speaking of fucking pandering and talking down to people, don't look up. Don't look up. So let's see. I described this movie to you as obnoxious.
Yep.
As pandering.
Mm-hmm.
As tone deaf.
Yep.
And as over long.
Yeah.
And I will stand by all of these things. My God, I don't remember the last time I hated a movie this much. As I've said repeatedly, my hatred for it is only exceeded by how much it hates me right back. Because, Jamie, I don't know if you know this. You and I and our love for social media and our celebrity-obsessed culture are equally responsible for the coming climate change apocalypse as the government, as big business, and as an irresponsible and disinterested media.
Yep, correct.
We are just as much to blame, Jamie, you and I.
You and me, Scott Hudson and Jamie Rubin, it's our fault.
The fucking Ariana Grande song that's in this movie— which the movie is like, the song is a parody. It's a satire. It's saying like celebrity culture and it's all bullshit and it's all fake. And they think they're talking about politics, but it's really about self-aggrandizing and they're not actually helping anyone at all. That's what this movie is. This movie is the Ariana Grande song within the movie.
Yep.
It's just rolling up a newspaper and hitting us all on the nose and also not doing us like the service of being funny or having really anything to say.
That's the big fucking problem I have with this movie. Like, sure, preach to the choir and pander and like all of those things. I'm fine with it, but fucking, can I get a joke?
Where are the jokes at?
Can I get one?
There are two.
In your estimation, what are the laughs?
There are three things that are funny in the movie. There is a recurring joke where Jennifer Lawrence continues to be flabbergasted that like a 4-star general lied to her and told her that she had to pay for snacks at the White House.
Yes.
Genuinely funny. Within the same scene, there is a story told by Rob Morgan about how one time he met Sting and Sting straight up farted right in front of him and stared him in the face. And he's like, and you know what? He got away with it, too. And then there's a bit at the end when they're in the grocery store, like the night that the meteor's going to hit the earth and kill everybody. And they're at fucking Whole Foods. And DiCaprio is like, we should get those little potatoes. What are the little potatoes called? And Jennifer Lawrence says, fingerling potatoes. And then Timmy Cham Cham, who plays like a fucking towny idiot bro.
Burnout.
Does the, what is this called? The like finger snapping thing that bros do?
I have no idea what it's called.
Where they like shake their hand at the wrist.
Shake their hand to make a snapping sound.
To make the snapping sound. And he does that and he's like, I fucking love fingerling potatoes. Genuinely hysterical and the hardest I laughed the entire time. And otherwise, fuck this movie so hard.
This was another one. This actually was one of those movies where I looked at it before I had heard your problems with it. And yeah. I was like, this looks like a thing that I should like.
Right.
And maybe I will watch it. And then heard you and I was like, it can't be as bad as Scott is saying. It can't possibly be. And then you encouraged me to watch it, I think, to punish me.
No, because...
And also because we're doing this fucking episode.
Well,
because
we're doing this. And also I thought, well, like, you know what? Not everybody hates this movie the way that I do. And that, you know, like, you and I both love Adam McKay's comedies. Like,
right.
The worst thing that happened to Adam McKay was, like, respectability. you know, they're the line between The Big Short and fucking Vice, and then this movie is like, oh man, I'm sure The Big Short would be almost impossible for me to watch now because I won't be able to wash the taste of this fucking movie out of my
right.
mouth. But yeah, I thought like worst case, like you would love it and we'd be able to have a good discussion about it. And but no, it's rancid dog shit.
So I'm like a third of the way through it, thinking to myself, it's not as bad as he's saying. Like it's not that great, but I'm not upset. And then I found myself just progressively getting madder about how it's not funny. And as you said, it feels like the movie has a rolled up piece of fucking newspaper and is hitting me on the face with it.
Yeah.
As though I'm the fucking problem.
Right. That sensibility and that tone and that lecturing quality works in The Big Short because it's not blaming the public and because it's also explaining something that is intentionally too complicated. Like that's right. how the fucking financial sector got away with the subprime mortgage crisis and everything is because people just didn't understand because it was so convoluted. And like, and the movie gets away with pandering and being obnoxious about it because it's so complicated and it totally works. But then this movie, it's doing the exact same thing, but like about shit that we all implicitly understand about the media and about politics. I mean, not all of us. Some people think this movie is like unveiling the truth of the world, but it's also blaming the audience, which yeah. is so obnoxious.
Both obnoxious and untrue.
Yeah, exactly. It that could be a small portion of like the root of the problem, but instead they lend at least as much screen time to the like anti-social media, anti-celebrity side of things as they do to the other three like major problems that are why, you know, my kid's going to grow up with gills or something and drinking his own recycled urine.
Yeah. So with this movie.
Yeah. So speaking of recycled urine, Jamie, what are we drinking?
I mean, I picked alternate pairings, one that is wine, one that isn't wine, both of which are bad.
So you're,
but
you're
both
not even,
of which I like.
So you're not even doing the audience the courtesy of being like, here's something nice to counter this shitty experience.
No, this is a little Novocaine for this shitty experience. Both are entirely pleasant, but both are not meant to be thought about at all.
Okay.
Like, let's shut our brains off entirely. On the non-wine side, Natural Light Natterdays, the strawberry lemonade flavored soda, basically, that you can just knock back a 30 rack and not even fucking think about it.
Wow. Okay. I'm not doing that.
Natterdays are my big guilty pleasure. I actually love them. It's strawberry lemonade and it tastes a little bit like beer. Just a little bit. And it's delightful. And it's if it's in the summertime, you put it in a glass over ice and it's fucking delightful and whatever. It's great.
How many Natterdays would I have to drink to ever be in a place where I might want to watch this movie again?
You would have to drink so many that you would already be in a hospital.
I don't want to go to a hospital right now.
Right.
Okay. I mean, ever, but right now. Especially.
For real.
Yeah.
The other one is the largest production, most faceless, most corporate wine probably made in Europe. We've definitely all seen this on the shelves, but no one knows how to pronounce it. It's Freixenet Cava, Freixenet.
Now, do you know how to pronounce it?
I do.
Okay,
yes.
Great.
Freixenet is the, as far as I know, the correct pronunciation. Get a magnum of it. Just skull that thing. And watch this movie if you must.
If you must, which I do not encourage that you do.
We just don't do it. It's, yeah. It, and the cast dude.
The cast is insane, and I think there's only a handful of performances in it, like a handful of people who should not be embarrassed by their work in it. Like, it's not just that the material is bad and that you're hampered by it. Like, I think DiCaprio is genuinely giving a terrible performance in the movie.
I agree.
Jennifer Lawrence has a really underserved part, and I think she kind of gets by. You know, the movie doesn't give her a lot of cringy moments. I fucking hate the Meryl Streep character and performance. I hate the Jonah Hill character and performance.
Well, I mean, the Jonah Hill character is meant, like, his whole presence there is him looking at the camera going, hate me.
Yeah, but that joke is worn out before his first scene is over, and then he gets so much goddamn screen time.
And we've already seen him play that character in a compelling way.
Yeah, exactly.
Several times.
A whole bunch of other movies.
Right.
Yeah. It's like, what if Jonah Hill's character from The Wolf of Wall Street, except not funny?
And the weird fucking, like, Electra complex shit between him and his mother,
yeah.
Meryl Streep, in the movie. Like, you're trying to make a joke. It is not funny.
Well, yeah, because they're just doing the Ben Ivanka thing.
Right.
Except, like, this is the problem with satire of those people, is that they're beyond satire. You can't satirize them. So instead, you're just inverting their relationship dynamic and having two world-class actors just, like, do mediocre work.
I don't know. Do you think maybe that if Meryl Streep actually took the part and was saying that Jonah Hill was hot, would that have been a funny joke?
I don't know. Maybe. I just, oh God, all of those fucking Oval Office scenes are terrible.
They're fucking bad.
There's only a couple of people. Like, God, even Cate Blanchett is terrible. It's a bad character, but I just hate that performance so much. Meanwhile, her biggest screen partner, aside from DiCaprio, is Tyler Perry, who fucking crushes it. I love Tyler Perry in this movie.
I agree.
Tyler Perry and Timmy Cham Cham and Mark Rylance are, like, Rylance, who plays it's kind of like a step to the left from Rylance's character in Ready Player One, where he's playing like another weirdo, like, tech billionaire.
Right.
I think he is genuinely funny, and his performance is so weird that it kind of, you almost bypass how one note and boring that character is. And also Melanie Lynskey, who, like, is one of the, her and Rob Morgan are, like, the only people who actually have, there's, like, integrity to those performances. She plays DiCaprio's wife that he, fucking spoilers, I hate this movie, he cheats on his wife with Cate Blanchett, and she's genuinely good and has a couple of good scenes and a couple of good laughs, and just everything else is just so.
Can we stop talking about this movie?
Yes,
now, please.
Yeah, I agree. Let's move on. Coda, a movie that I put off watching for so long because it was just like there's at least one every year, and it's a Sundance crowd pleaser. And the Sundance crowd pleaser very specifically means an indie movie that probably has, like, a couple of, like, medium level stars that people would recognize. And it's about Americana and a very specific slice of life Americana. But it's like, as I told you, it's paint by numbers. The script is super obvious, and it's the kind of movie that studios used to make if studios were interested in making, like, dramas for adults anymore. But so Coda is, if you think about it at all, you know exactly where this movie is going to end up. It's very obvious in its direction, but it's also very specific. Like, the movie excels in the specificity of her being a child of deaf adults, of her, the specifics of this family where it's her two parents and her older brother are all deaf. And not only that, but, like, the specifics of they also run, like, a fishing boat, and the difficulty of their fishing business, not only them being deaf and maybe being taken advantage of by the, like, almost like the fishing union, like the fishermen's, like, sellers representatives who are, like, taking advantage of them. And then, like, the EPA people who come in who are also kind of hurting them. All the specifics are terrific. It is a crowd pleaser, though. Like, I can imagine, like, an audience going apeshit for this movie. I told you it was a crowd pleaser. I told you it was bright. It's very warm and easy to engage with. And for as much as it can be, like, there's sadness to it and there's melancholy, it's still very, very, very light. And it doesn't bring you down, you know? And I said that it hurts so good. Because it does, man. Like, the last half hour of the movie, I was kind of mad at myself. Like, fuck, I shouldn't be crying this hard. But like, there's three moments over the last half hour of the film that just like wrecked me. And it was like, as I think I told you in our movie chat about it, like, if you need a good cry to like a cathartic cry, if you've got some bad shit in you, like this is like a life affirming cry. This like you cry not because it's sad, but because it's beautiful, because the relationships are great and because the emotional beats are so terrific. It's not a great movie, but it is a great experience. And I just I had a wonderful time with it.
I got to watch this movie if only for that big cathartic cry. I could use one of those.
It's so good. It also, you'll love this, has a world-class fart joke.
Ooh, love those.
Troy Kotsur, who, as I've mentioned, is nominated for Best Supporting Actor. He has a terrific fart joke in, I think, his first or second scene of the movie. And that should be his Oscar clip when they announce all the supporting actor. Not like he does amazing work throughout the movie, but if there were a movie god, he would say that, yes, the bit where the deaf guy makes a fart joke should absolutely be his clip. It's a good laugh.
Love it. Absolutely love it.
So Jim Jab, where does all that take your 12.5% alcohol brain?
I would be dead if my brain was 12.5% alcohol.
Metaphor. It's a metaphor.
I know. So I feel like maybe if I had the experience that you had watching this movie, that like really, really great experience, that I might not have taken the route that I took. But you gave me Paint by Numbers, extremely specific, crowd pleaser, bright, and then Hurt So Good, that was the one that I threw out.
So we're not doing something like Megatanic and Teeth Biting.
No.
Okay.
No. This is a crowd pleaser. This is very much a crowd pleaser. This also is a very, very specific style that has become a thing that people look for specifically. I said specifically a number, whatever.
It's okay.
And it's very Paint by Numbers. Like this is, you come into this area and you make this wine. So this is coming from Provence in the south of France. This is the Miraval Provence Rosé. Miraval of Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie fame. This is their wine.
You have beef with this wine, right?
I really don't. Like, it's fine. It's a fine wine. I think that it's more expensive than it should be based on how it tastes. But, like, it's got nice packaging and it's fine.
But you have beef, like, with the famos getting into wine. You just Instagrammed something the other day. Was it about Leo? Were you mad at Leo for doing a wine thing? I forget.
I can't remember.
There was some famous handsome white man's face that you Instagrammed that you were mad about another celebrity wine.
Yeah. I just...
Whatever.
I vent into the internet and then it is gone from my brain.
That's what internet is for.
Exactly.
Social media is just a place to expel garbage from your life and then infect other people with it.
That's correct.
Not unlike this podcast.
You're welcome, dear listener.
Now go buy a $250 bottle of wine. You fucker.
This one is $25 MSRP. I didn't even bother to look for where you can find it because it's everywhere. It's a massive production wine. Basically, everyone listening to this podcast, if you've ever been in a wine shop, you've seen it on a shelf. It's got a really exaggerated, like, kind of bulbous body to the bottle and a really, like, tiny sticker on the front that says Miraval with a little flower on it. It's a Provence Rosé. It's light. It's easy. It's bright. It is, you know, moderate plus in acidity. You can drink it without thinking about it. It's a Provence Rosé. It's tasty. And it's very much like everyone in the area that makes a Provence Rosé makes it in this style. It's Paint by Numbers. It is the thing that people look for. And the notoriety of specifically Provence Rosé is what drove the price over the course of 5 to 10 years from $15 now to $25.
Jamie, once again, you're being very thoughtful in your pairings. You're looking at what I'm saying and you're doing the work.
I try. I really try.
I applaud it. All right. Well, so check out that Miraval Provence Rosé. And again, like, I don't mean to give Coda backhanded compliments. Like, it is all of those things that I said, but like, goddamn, does it work despite its own failures and like kind of the mediocrity of the script. There's a lot of stuff like with her singing teacher, the main character Ruby, like, God, she has a fucking outstanding voice. When she does this Joni Mitchell song at the end, holy shit, did I just fuck, like, just from the tone of her voice, like the waterworks start coming. And then the emotional stuff in the scene starts happening and it's unbelievable.
And by the way, the wine also, it achieves that sort of like, this is just delicious.
Yeah.
Even though it is sort of the center of like it, it's this paint by numbers, like not very thoughtful kind of thing.
Yeah. But yeah, I highly recommend Coda. It, you know what Coda is? It's a great movie to watch with your parents. Mm. It's a good experience. It's a good cry. It's wholesome. I really like that movie a lot. All right. Next up, Drive My Car. Drive My Car.
This is the next one on my list to watch.
Oh, man.
I will be watching it probably this week.
It is so good. Holy shit, Drive My Car. So I told you that it was austere. And for me, the austerity is in the... There's a scene in the movie where our main character, Kafuku-san, who is, as stated, he's an actor. He's a stage actor and director, and he's putting on this production of Chekhov's Uncle Vanya. It's super interesting. His productions are all multilingual. So, like, he cast Japanese, Chinese, Korean actors, and they all speak in their own native tongues.
Oh, that's cool.
It's super wild to watch how they're putting this staging together. But there's this scene where the actors are kind of struggling with the total lack of direction that he's giving them during rehearsals, where they're just sitting around and they're just reading the text over and over and over again. And the one actress, she says, you know, we're not robots. We want to act. We want to bring emotionality to it. Like, you got to give us some direction. And he's like, basically, like, just read the text. All I want you to do right now is just read the text, which from what I've read is like Hamaguchi, the director, is his methodology. Like, he just works on the text with his actors, and the performances are very, very, very restrained until like near the end. There's very little like emotion that is expressed. And it, for me, that's the austerity, it's a huge emotional story for like the two principal characters and then like this one secondary character. Hugely emotional story for them, but it's so much restraint in the depiction of it. And you get to bring your own emotional experience to it. And also just watching them, just like trying to repress a lot of shit. You know, people don't have big Oscar clip speeches and scenes all the time. Like, your emotionality and your experiences, they live in you. And if you have to go about your day-to-day life, they live inside you. And, you know, you don't always show it. And that for me is the austerity in the movie. It's nuanced. It's a movie that, like I said, like, put your phone away. You just have to watch it and pay attention to all of these little details in performance and physicality and staging and blocking and recurring lines of dialogue and ideas. And it's all about these little tiny details. The next thing I told you is that it is about the accumulation of the details. It's a movie that, while I didn't like cry or get super emotional throughout the experience, the end credits rolled and I was just suddenly overwhelmed. The whole of the 3 hours just suddenly lands and resolves, and I think this flawless and thoughtful way. And it just like, but it's that accumulation, like, and you couldn't have done it. You could do this plot in a 90-minute movie, but it wouldn't be the same movie. It's all about the buildup of those tiny details. I told you it has a long windup, which I was hoping would give you something in terms of like the start or the finish or like that kind of
right
palette trajectory of a wine. But for me, man, this movie does something that I fucking love, which is that the opening credits come 40 minutes into the movie.
Jesus.
And that first 40 minutes is basically just a prologue that goes by very quickly and then sets the stage for the actual plot that I've described, which is him putting on this stage production. Such a baller move whenever somebody waits that long to give you the opening credits. I'm always thrilled by that. And then I also told you it was breathtaking because there are a couple of scenes. There's this one scene in a car and then another scene shortly after that one where these two characters have a cigarette. But like, there are scenes where I was just like, my jaw was hanging down and I was just holding my breath, just in the suspense of how is this emotional scene going to play out between these two characters? And we've been waiting to see where it's going to go. It's a stunner, man. I think you'll love it.
So this was the first pairing that I actually arrived at because the words spoke to me in a really specific way. I'm not even going to bury the lead. It's austere, nuanced, accumulation of details, long windup, breathtaking. It's as though you are a really up your ass Somm and you are describing Mosel Riesling. There was kind of no other way that I could take it. And so once I arrived in that place, then I just have to decide on, you know, the ripeness level that I want to go for and pick a producer that I like. So it was super duper easy. Mosel Valley Rieslings tend to be these, especially in their youth, super, super like crisp and austere. They don't give you a lot until they reveal that accumulation of the tiny little details about the wines. You really have to stick your nose in the glass and think about them and allow the time, the wine, the time to contact the air and to sort of unravel and show you all of the different points that it has to offer. So I'm specifically going for the lowest on the ripeness spectrum in Mosel, which is called Cabinet. It's the first pass of harvest in the Mosel Valley is called your Cabinet harvest. And they are very ageable, but they tend to be the wines that are drunk more young. They tend to be a little bit less sweet. They are very much less ripe in their fruit character.
Do you want to say what the wine is? Like who makes it?
Yes.
Do you think that would be helpful?
So Weiser Künstler is the name of the producer. You know, they're one of these several generations long winemaking families in the Mosel Valley. They don't have a lot of land. They make a little bit of wine and they put a lot of attention to detail into the wines that they do make. I chose the Wolfer Sonnele, which is one of their single vineyard wines, the Cabinet. I chose Wolfer Sonnele because it is the one of their single vineyard wines that I have tasted. They make a couple of others. I can't really speak to them. I would expect them to sort of fit into all of these things that you have said, but I picked the one that I've worked with before.
Well, Jamie, if we're making disclosures about things, then I should confess that the filmmaker Hamaguchi has been on my radar for a very long time. Several of his films have played in festivals that I've worked at before. I've always wanted to. I've always heard his movies were so great, and I just never put in the time. And then this is like his breakthrough movie on the international stage, and so I finally fucking watched it. And so I have never seen the previous works of this filmmaker, but I will be, thanks to Drive My Car, be going back through and watching all of his features, including one of which that is, I believe, 5 hours long. And I've heard it's wonderful.
5 hours?
Yeah.
Oh my God. So this wine is MSRP at $31. It's a little bit hard to find because, as I said, this is a small winemaking family. They don't make a lot of wine. The wines tend to be pretty allocated and difficult even for buyers to acquire. So I believe the 2020 vintage is sold out. The 21s should be coming out within the next month or so. Keep your eyes on your local hip wine shop. Sorry, those of you in Pennsylvania, you're going to have to keep your eyes on your not local hip wine shop, probably one in Brooklyn or Manhattan.
Now, Jamie, you've never really spoken to me before about your feelings about Pennsylvania's laws about wine and alcohol
Don't
distribution.
Don't fucking start.
Okay, so next up, after Drive My Car, is Belfast. Oh, Belfast. I was dreading watching this, but as with all things, I really did try to come to it with an open mind.
Didn't pay off for you?
Oh, boy. Belfast is written and directed by Kenneth Branagh, a guy who I like more as an actor than as a director. It has been described by many, I'm not the first person to say this, as it's Kenneth Branagh's Roma,
What's Roma?
Roma!
What's Roma?
Roma is Alfonso Cuarón's Academy Award-winning film from a few years ago. That movie is a black and white, not quite nostalgic, but it's black and white. It's him doing something autobiographical about his own childhood, growing up in the Roma neighborhood of Mexico City during times of like political upheaval. And that's largely in the background of the story that he's telling. And it's gorgeous digital black and white photography, a lot of long takes, really immaculate and immersive sound design. And this movie is that minus artistry, minus Cuarón's like attention to detail, minus the sensitivity to humanity and performances, minus...
Don't hold back, Scott. Tell us how you really feel.
I'm telling you how I feel.
I feel like you're holding it back a little bit.
Minus a great script, minus fantastic performances, minus a verisimilitude that you might want if you're doing something about, you know, not only your own life, but also like difficulties that other people experienced in the real world. Yeah, man, I really did not fucking like this movie at all. I was closing in on the end and I'm like, God, I really got to do a pee break, which I don't like doing during movies, but I had to pee. And so I hit pause and I'm like, Jesus, there's still a half an hour left. It is the longest 97-minute movie that I have seen in quite a while. But Belfast just didn't do it for me at all, not even a little bit.
Yeah, and you gave me some pretty harsh words for it.
Yeah, I did. So I said it's artless. It is, oh man, it's a fucking clunker. The comparison to Roma is really not flattering, and I feel like Branagh just invites it, and it is like, It's obvious the screenplay, like for all the complaints and things that I said about Coda being like paint by numbers in the script, like that movie is fucking, I don't know, Uncle Vanya compared to this thing. It's saccharine. It's super sickly sweet. Like it's very nostalgic and it's him talking lovingly about his family and his childhood and his wonderful grandparents, and there's this God, it's just not good. It's just not a good movie. It's like sickly sweet, and it's flat. Just like visually, it is not interesting. Like Kenneth Branagh has never, like, his strength as a director, and I think he is a talented director in some areas, but like visually is not where his gifts lie. It doesn't look great. The sound design, again, like this is just the Roma comparison that the movie invites for itself, especially early on when there are a bunch of longer takes that are trying to like immerse you in the street, this like little integrated neighborhood of Protestants and Catholics. And there's long takes and there's this attempt at attention to sound design that should be immersive to you. And instead, I just found it's why I find the sound nomination for the movie so baffling, because I thought the actual sound, like the mix and the effects, I just found like very blunt and hammering and obvious and thudding. And there's no like gradients in the intensity, you know, it's there's no peaks and valleys. It's just like all kind of the same level and involvement from the audience at the same time. And I found it super neutral and uninteresting.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
Belfast, whatever. It's got the second best Jamie Dornan singing performance of the year. After, of course, the completely shut out by the Oscars, fucking all time masterpiece comedy, Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar. Could have been nominated for best song. Honestly, could have been nominated for best production design.
That movie is so much fun.
Anyway. I digress.
Yes, you do.
Tell me about the wine that you paired all with, right. Belfast.
So
it's Kenneth Branagh's Belfast, Jamie. Everybody's Irish. Even though some of the people in the movie are actually Irish, they all talk like they're leprechaun Irish. Fuck. I'm sorry.
No, you're not. Sorry. You don't have to be sorry. It's fine.
I'm not sorry to Irish people. I'm sorry for this movie.
Okay, so I've already done kind of a mean pairing. Like, Natterdays and Freshen et Cava, like, fucking, just don't watch, don't look up.
Please, please don't.
But if you have to, numb the experience. And so I wanted to do a wine that I can actually put my whole body behind for this one. I didn't want to just be glib about it. I feel like one time being glib is enough. So I went with Messiah Cap Est from Bekaa Valley, Lebanon. Messiah is a pretty important winery in Lebanon and specifically in the Bekaa Valley. They make really, really special wines. And this one, I think specifically just is the opposite of everything that you said, right? This wine is creative and interesting and engaging. It's the opposite of obvious. Like you wouldn't think to do this specific thing. It's a totally dry wine, so the opposite of saccharine, but also like it's layered and textured and has peaks and valleys and has intrigue and interest. There's just a lot going on here to maybe distract you from the obviousness and boringness of Belfast, I hope. So the Cap Est is a 50-50 Grenache and Mourvèdre blend. The thing about it that's not obvious, that is like this really unique perspective, is that these vines are planted on the easternmost point in the Bekaa Valley on a west-facing slope. And typically wines are on east-facing slopes to catch a little bit more sun, and particularly with these varieties that require a little bit more sun to get ripe, you would think that you would want an east-facing slope, but this results in a wine that has a lot of lightness and a lot of elegance to it, as opposed to, you know, other Grenache Mourvèdre blends that I have had that are like really dark and brooding. This is kind of the opposite in character, using the same grapes. I just find this wine really, really compelling. I think the winery is great. I love their farming practices. I love that they try and give back to the area. Buy Messiah Cap Est, where honestly, buy all of the Messiah wines. The other thing from Messiah that you could have with this movie that would just make you drunk is that they also distill an Arak. Arak is the traditional spirit of the area, which is anise flavored and high proof and just gets you drunk very quickly. So you could have that, both of which are available at Astor Wine and Spirits. The Cap Est from Messiah is $38.
I'm sorry, I wasn't listening at all. I was just thinking about how fucking obnoxious Belfast was.
Yeah, I understand. I will not be watching this movie.
No, I can't imagine.
It just won't be happening.
You would care for it. You should watch Roma, though. Roma's a knockout.
Roma, I will watch. I will put that on my list. We have one more movie to get through.
We do. All right, so the last of the Best Picture nominees, the one that I watched most recently. Something else that I've been putting off because it didn't sound like it'd be my kind of movie, and I was very wrong, is King Richard. King Richard, it's very warm. There is humanity to it, and the depiction of Richard Williams and Venus and Serena and the whole family is just like, I laughed and I experienced so much joy and love and heartbreak with these people. It's grounded. There is an emotional and a tangible reality to the movie. I almost said earthy in the description, but like, it's not quite that, but it is.
I like grounded.
Yeah. Well, because like Richard Williams is, I don't know much about the man. I don't really follow tennis, you know, at all. From what I had heard about him prior and the way he's depicted in the movie by Will Smith, who is himself like not a normal human being, you'd think that that character and that kind of outsized Will Smith performance would sort of like unbalance the whole thing. And it doesn't. Like, it still very much feels like it's connected to reality and to real circumstances. It's tactile. It's shot by like the great director of photography, Robert Elswit. So it's this like gorgeous, very tangible looking movie. And you not that you spend a lot of time with textures, but like you just, it feels like the real world. Like you have this like real lived in quality to it. There is also a myth making to it. And this is part of why I was not interested in it, in part because it just felt like Will Smith wants an Oscar, but also in this, I was a little bit surprised by it. I didn't realize that Venus and Serena were executive producers, but like the movie works for me despite the myth making of it all, because it, anytime anybody questions his parenting or his decisions, like he's like the sports equivalent of like
the pageant mothers?
Yes, exactly. He's the sports equivalent of that, like forcing his daughters into it, but then the daughters are always into it and then they never question it. You know? And then there's a moment where one of their trainers will say, like, Richard, and John Bernthal doing great mustache work in this movie, but like, Richard, like, you say you're doing this for the girls, but then I see you on TV and you've got all these businesses. And like, it'll have a moment where it questions and then it seems as though it's forgiven and that everything is okay with what he's doing. Like where you question his behavior, but then it's ultimately redeemed. And then the movie just like it basically ends with him being completely validated with the enormous, like insane success of his two daughters. And it is very much myth-making for the man, and it is also Will Smith myth-making. Like, Will Smith is one of these guys where when he's in a movie—
Is it Will Smith-making?
That was pretty good, Jamie. That was pretty good.
I appreciate your validation.
Yeah, I mean—
It was right there. I couldn't let it not be said.
You could have, though. But what if you did? It's something we should think about. But another time. But it tricks you is the thing. The movie is so compelling and such a great drama, and the performances are so good— Until the end credits rolled and I saw executive produced by Venus and Serena, and you see like the thing that I fucking hate when biopics and based on a true stories do, where it's like, here's the picture of the real guy and here's actual footage from the scene that we already saw. Until I got to that point, it tricked me and it totally won me over, and I wasn't questioning it's propaganda is a strong word, but like it's mythologizing the man. And so that brings me to the last thing I told you, which that it is Big Willie style. Like,
woo!
It's a Will Smith movie. Every Will Smith movie is in some way about Will Smith or about how Will Smith wants to be perceived. Man, it's a big swing. He's got like this like big Louisiana drawl. It is a not small performance, but I think he is genuinely terrific in the movie. But it's also very much about Will Smith and what we want to think of him, and maybe even what kind of dad we want to think he is.
I'm going to have to watch it.
It's a good movie.
I was in the same way that I think you described, just totally uninterested in watching this movie because it just didn't seem like a thing that I would like. Yeah. So I will be watching it. This was also the last of the pairings that I came to because I was just looking at these words going like, what can I possibly do with this? You know, and I know that you were baiting me with Big Willie style.
I thought you might have fun with that.
For sure.
Your fondness for 90s hip hop in particular.
Yes, definitely. And when I finally locked in on a wine for this, I was very excited and I remain very excited. So the wine that I chose is Once in Future Wines Bedrock Vineyard Zinfandel. It's available at firstbottlewines.com for $50. Once in Future is made by Joel Peterson. Joel Peterson is the founder of Ravenswood Winery. Ravenswood, which basically repopularized Zinfandel, also in a way ruined Zinfandel. There's a mythology about the Ravenswood Winery. There's even a kernel of untruth in the myth. People say that in the winery, there was a poster on the wall that said, "No wimpy wines." You talk to Joel and that is untrue. It didn't exist, but it became a motto for the winery, and people like got bumper stickers that said, "No wimpy wines." And so Ravenswood is in a way responsible, or at the very least, partly responsible for this trend of over-extracted, like crazy high alcohol wines, both from Cabernet and from Zinfandel.
And you love those. You love the over-extracted, high alcohol, dark reds. That's your favorite.
You love the wines
and you love the trend and their market dominance.
Not engaging. That's the other thing, is that a lot of the Ravenswood wines in the beginning weren't that way. They were actually quite nuanced and lighter in body, and trying to paint a picture of the specific vineyards that they came from. Joel Peterson did a lot for preserving old vine vineyards in California in a time when that wasn't important to really anybody else. Then, you know, he likes to make money. He sold the winery to Constellation, big old company, and they took the winery in a different direction. And now the Ravenswood wines aren't, in my estimation, particularly good. But he also had a son named Morgan Twain Peterson, who's now a master of wine and proprietor of Bedrock Winery, which you and I have drunk together before, is a huge part of my cellar at home. Morgan is continuing in his father's work of producing really thoughtful site-specific wines, but also focused on old vines. And together, they own the Bedrock Vineyard, and they both source fruit from it, and they both make totally different wines from it. I find the warmth between the two of them, there's, you know, it isn't just Morgan following in his father's footsteps and just like living in his shadow. Morgan is building on that and doing his own thing, and in fact, taking what his father did and making it even better and more specific and more widespread and affecting more minds with it. And in his old age, as his like retirement project, Joel is able to make the wines that he was making in his youth that really made him excited about wine, the site-specific stuff, with a winery that he calls Once and Future. I think that the warmth between father and son, that sort of grounded, like, this is where I came from feeling that Joel brings to Once and Future, the wines themselves are really textured and tactile in that like, they give you a different sense of the place vis-a-vis the mouthfeel. The tannins have a really specific texture to them. And that tactility for me is indicative of each different vineyard, and also the differences between the winemaking style of Once and Future and of Bedrock. I think there's this myth about Joel, and also now emerging about Morgan, that I think will continue. And these are Zinfandels. Like, even though they're on the lighter side of Zinfandels, they're still big, they're still powerful, they're still Big Willie style.
Man, I really thought I was going to throw you for a loop there. I really thought I was going to totally fuck your day up with throwing Big Willie style in there. God damn it, Jamie, you're good at this. I'm so glad that there's no like annual rankings of the wine that you actually care about and would want to invest an episode in, because if you had to turn the tables on me, I don't know that I would be able to deal with something like that. You're good at this, Jamie. You're not bad at it.
Thank you very much.
I mean, everything else about you as a broadcaster, I find lackluster, but the substance of what you're doing, you're really engaging.
Love you too, buddy.
So where can this bottle be found?
Firstbottlewines.com for $50. I encourage everyone to purchase it. I think it's just truly great wine. It's good to drink now, and it will age for a further 20 to 40 years if you so choose.
Well, that wraps us up here in terms of talking about the Best Picture nominees, in terms of talking about where Jamie thinks you might go with pairing them. Definitely some, you know, totally cost-appropriate bottles just to go along with a casual movie-watching evening. Definitely not pricing anybody out. Certainly not me.
Sometimes it be like that, Scotty.
Sometimes it be. All right, so Jamie, we've come to the end talking about Oscar Schmoskers and the 10 Best Picture nominees.
That's correct.
Now to return to our semi-regularly scheduled programming, we're returning to Pinot Grigio and The Matrix Resurrections. What is the next Pinot Grigio or Gris that you're making everybody drink?
So next up from the Finger Lakes, we're going to Red Newt Cellars, Curry Creek Vineyards, Pinot Gris, vintage 2013, because I wanted to show something with a little bit of age.
And we recorded that a few weeks ago, and I don't remember if I liked it or not, so I'll be looking forward to listening along with everyone else.
You did like it. Spoilers.
You're gaslighting me. Well, our discussion of Red Newt's Curry Creek 2013 coincided with a very lengthy discussion of the characters of Tom / Neo, Tiffany / Trinity, and Smith / Smith. Three, I think, fascinating characters, terrific performances, and we have a long discussion about partnerships and this, like, intrinsic push-pull of partnerships in the movie that I think is super fascinating.
For those of you interested in grabbing the wine, it's available direct, rednewtcellars.com, 28 United States dollars.
All right, Jamie, take us home.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us. This was quite the discussion of the Best Picture nominees for 2021. Please feel free to follow us on the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod. Feel free to email us if you have any questions, comments, concerns, or complaints at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com. Make sure you tell a friend and also rate, review, and follow this podcast wherever you get your pods.
This episode was produced and edited by Scott Hudson. That's me. Our social media presence is thanks to the fine work of Jamie. One word. It's like Cher or Madonna. Jamie. That's him right over there.
I'm kind of okay with that.
Yeah. All right, never mind. Let's do it again. Our social media presence is thanks to James.
F*** you, buddy.
James with a Z.
God damn it.
Also, shout out to friend of the show, Ross Kennard, for designing our new legally distinctive enough from the Muppets to avoid us getting sued by the Disney Corporation art that hopefully is gracing all of your screens right now.
Everyone, remember, drink more wine and watch more movies. It's good for you, we promise.
Movies, they're good.
Wine's good too.
I haven't even done any rants yet about snubs because, like, I just can't be fucking bothered. I just can't be fucking bothered. Whatever, they're the Oscars.
And once again, we've already said it, but the movies, at least in the Best Picture category, are largely good.
It's a good crop. It's a really good crop. It was a good year. 2021 is going to be like, we're going to look back on it as like one of those freak years, like, what, 1941 and what are the other like great years? Like 1941 and everybody talks about like 1999 and 2007. And 2021 is like a freak year in part because so many great movies were delayed
right
from 2020. Like West Side Story was supposed to be a Christmas 2020 release as just one example. But yeah, it was a great year. But, you know, there's shit that frustrates me that is overlooked.
You?
Yeah.
Shocking.
I mean, like the
I'm stunned.
The snub that should bother me, but I kind of appreciate it, is that Matrix Resurrections isn't nominated for anything. It's not nominated for visual effects. It's not nominated for production design. It's not nominated for sound, which is fucking crazy. That's the insane. Sound is so, or score, because I think the score by Tom Tykwer and I forget the other composer's name is fucking outstanding. But like, also that movie's like, it's disreputable. I'm glad it's not nominated because the movie doesn't need validation. The movie is like a middle finger to validation. Like, no, fuck you. Yes. I'm going to tell you all the reasons that you're stupid.
I love that.
But yeah, it's just like, you know, Green Knight getting completely shut out, like, drives me crazy.
Oh, really? No nominations
Nothing
for
Green Knight? And like, the two categories where I would have loved to have seen Green Knight get nominated are production design and cinematography. And I can't really argue with any of the things that were nominated in either of those categories. So like, it's hard to get mad about it.
Right.
But yeah, like we were just talking about in West Side Story, like Mike Feist as Riff in West Side Story.
So good.
Not nominated, like outstanding, unbelievably great performance.
A magnetic performance.
Yeah. Kind of crazy to me that he's not nominated. Alana Haim in Licorice Pizza. Everybody says she should have been nominated for supporting actress. I think she's the fucking lead of that movie.
I agree.
Crazy that she's not nominated. This gets tricky because, you know, the Oscars are largely about the American industry, but like it is crazy to me that, like, with all the buzz on The Worst Person in the World, that Renata Reinsve is not nominated for Best Actress, like an amazing performance. France totally fucked it up by not making Titan their, like, official selection to the Oscars this year. I think Agathe Roussel like would have been an easy shoo-in for a Best Actress nomination, but also like it's the fucking Oscars, whatever. Whatever, man.
Scott is post-anger on the Oscars.
It's whatever. And you know, most of the categories are pretty good. And there's just a couple of things that drive me crazy, like any of the nominations for Don't Look Up, which is like, if there was a category for like most obnoxious and smug fucking scolding of a movie, like Don't Look Up should have received it. But Original screenplay. Original screenplay by Adam McKay, based on a story by Adam McKay and David Sirota, two fucking guys who were scolding and bitching at people on Twitter when critics didn't like the movie. Because if you don't like the movie, obviously you don't care about climate change. Go fuck yourself.
Go fuck yourselves.
The score is really good, though.